David Halpin and Professor Andrew Gamble, thank you for talking to the Cambridge Judge Business School podcast series tonight. We're here at the debate, Measuring National Wellbeing. What matters to you? Perhaps if we begin by you, David, first, you're Director of the Behavioural Insights Team at the Cabinet Office. Wellbeing now firmly on the political agenda.
Well, it's certainly across countries, a lot of interest in measuring it and what's its policy implications, so yes.
And in terms of Cameron's speech, he came into office, people say it's now not just about economics and GDP, we're putting well-being and those other factors firmly into the measurement of our happiness. Is that, do you think, a big policy change in the sense that it's not just about economics anymore, it's about how we feel?
Well, there are a couple of different things in there. One is there's an agreement across a number of countries that there are limitations to what GDP does and does not capture. And there are a number of things which are reasonably well rehearsed now, but that doesn't capture well. Some ecological things about something comes to capital. There are classic examples around if you have a tsunami, when actually it drives up GDP on the way it's measured right now because your houses are destroyed. That doesn't count, and yet when they're rebuilt, that does count. So there are a number of omissions from it, and one of them, as identified by Stiglitz and also identified by analysts in the UK, includes subjective well-being measures. The next question, of course, is why would it be consequential? You touched on policy. The sense is, well, first we have to see where this road would lead, but if you looked at a broader basket of measures when you're trying to think about progress, then are there some things that would lead you to put more emphasis on, such as relationships?
And you talked about people having time to do the homework with their kids, the difference in extra hours commuting makes to our lives. These are very much, if you like, soft policy options. Do you think we're going to see them integrated into the mainstream political agenda more in the future?
Well, the fact is at the moment there's often not enough data or information to use it in formal policy analysis. But as it comes through, it's not just about government using this data. Actually, it's for all of us to use it in everyday life. And that's the interesting, empowering aspects of it. If we have to make all kinds of choices about where we live and where we work, and it's fascinating and important for us to have more insight into, well, what will that mean? How will we feel? Will we be pleased with the decision that we made in a year or two or 5 years' time? And so it actually is a way of informing citizens themselves, so not just for government.
And if we go to you, Professor Gamble, you said the debate is a very powerful one coming at the present time when perhaps lots of people might be feeling economically insecure and losing their jobs. Why is it powerful?
Well, I think because all the political parties have become interested in well-being. I think what's new is as David says, the idea of subjective well-being. I mean, governments have always considered non-market factors in the past. What's really new is actually trying to find some measures of happiness, measures of subjective well-being, and integrate them into policy. And it fits with a general search by governments to do more than just a top-down process of policy formation. As David was saying, it's actually trying to develop forms of information which can be made available to citizens so that citizens themselves are empowered to become the agents.
But in empowering the citizens to become the agents, you know more about us. It could be interpreted, as you said in your talk, but of central planners interfering or governments interfering in our lives.
Well, I think that's the criticism that some people make of it. They see it as another way by which government gets another set of policies which actually come from the top. But I think that there's more things than that going on here. I mean, I obviously that is that is one risk, but I think there is a genuine interest in finding ways in which government can become more decentralized, and these sort of measures of subjective well-being The point is that individuals are being asked to actually construct them. I mean, actually to tell the people doing the surveys what actually matters most to them. And that's the interest, that the additional knowledge that is gained from that is actually very useful to the individuals themselves. And it's a way of a society actually understanding more about itself and therefore potentially adopting measures and behaviour which actually helps to improve well-being. And that is a very, you know, it's a challenging vision, but it's also really quite an exciting vision if it could be pulled off.
But it's not a sinister 1984 vision in the sense people aren't going to talk about their ill-being, and if politicians and political parties know more about us, surely they're going to use that information to get us to vote for them at the next election. You know, it's a circular argument, isn't it?
Well, the safeguard against that is that the knowledge is widely available. And clearly, if government was just collecting this knowledge secretly and then developing manipulative strategies, that would be very undesirable. So it has to be an open, pluralist process. But if it's that, then, you know, there are the safeguards are there.
But David, at one time it might have seemed impossible that we would have had a behavioural insights team in the Cabinet Office. That shows how far this happiness and well-being agenda has been, if you like, mainstreamed these days.
Well, no, to be clear, the behavioural insight team doesn't mainly do anything on well-being. I mean, a lot of it is to do with most policy has strong behavioural components, be it whether we recycle or whether we walk to school, whether you commit crime or whether you look after your health or not. And so that isn't just to do with well-being. And there are lots of insights that come from the psychology and economics which have strong policy relevance.
And you might say nudging us to these better lifestyles in the future. In terms of the measurement, do you trust the measurements of well-being, and where do you think this debate is going to go in the future?
Well, it's been for national statistician to develop some robust measures, and that's partly the point. Also, to your question earlier about, you know, government manipulation, it's important that it stays independent from government and the data goes to the public domain. So can it be measured robustly? I mean, the wider academic literature says yes, it is, and it looks like a lot of these kind of measures have been developed. They match up with what other people's judgments of whether someone is happy or not, or satisfied with their life. So there's lots of evidence, and they sort of behave in ways that you think they might do. So I think the measurement issue is perfectly crackable.
And Professor Gamble, do you agree with that? Have you got any concerns about this well-being debate, and where do you think it will lead to?
Well, I don't think it's, you know, it's not clearly not the whole answer for public policy, but I think where it will lead is that it does mean that there will be a more intelligent conversation about public policy and about some of the broader effects of economic growth and of what it is that citizens most desire and what will make citizens most happy. I mean, you know, Bentham talked about the greatest happiness of the greatest number, and the American Declaration of Independence talked about the pursuit of happiness. I mean, these are, you know, in that sense, these aren't new ideas. This is what modern Western culture has been about for a very long time, but we haven't always been very good at focusing upon these things, so that and other factors have come to dominate. So potentially, and of course, the difficulty will always come that there will be trade-offs, there will be hard choices. Things are never straightforward. But the hope of people behind the well-being agenda is that there will be more intelligent policy and more information available to citizens.
And you're not at all cynical that a well-being debate and the measurement of all this at a time when people were seeing massive cutbacks, job losses, can the two comfortably sit together?
Well, that's up to politicians, really. I mean, they have to demonstrate that they can have some hard-edged policies on well-being that actually do make a difference to people. So it's if they just stay at a very general level and just choose to use the term well-being to describe any policy that they're adopting, then of course it won't work. But so what it has to be is that they have to show that they're prepared to take some hard decisions in actually to improve people's well-being and help citizens to do so.
Well, we'll let you have the final word, David. Is that the challenge for the politicians now, those hard choices and decisions, and what might they be?
Well, it's clearly not an either-or with economic growth. I mean, you have to deliver growth and so on. But there are additional questions it certainly raises. You have to make real choices about, shall you spend more money on this or less on that? And as far as it can help communities and governments and indeed individuals make those judgments, then that seems a good thing.
Okay, well, thank you both for talking to me tonight at the Cambridge Judge Business School podcast series, Measuring National Wellbeing, What Matters to You? Professor Gamble, David Halpin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.